This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 28th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 33rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. On this show, we've raided the local idea grocer and lovingly picked only the finest and freshest ingredients for our cultural bouillabaisse. And I'm the bloody chef, so you know you're in safe hands. What fresher way to start than with the mighty Giles Corran, restaurant critic of the London Times and author of a new how-to guide to eating out.
When you tip, you are not tipping for the service you've had, you're tipping for the service you want to get next time. So give the guy a tenner, thanks, it was marvellous. What's your name again? Pedro, great. So then go back within a week, so he hasn't got time to forget.
And people then at home are writing this down.
I hope they are.
We'll also hear how to redesign an artistic icon. Freeze magazine has just gone under the knife for a spot of surgery. We chat to the editor and art director about their new face.
I was very surprised about this, that someone has noticed the little shadows behind the pictures in the review section, which is just such a tiny detail. But I'm glad that people are seeing these things and noticing it.
And we'll have a rootin' tootin' live Midori House session from Jason Isbell, as chatted to by Andrew Muller.
In the States, as far as art and music and those kind of things go, a lot of people make the division between northern and southern, but it's really between rural and urban.
And more besides, like Los Carpinteros and the Cannes Film Festival and 1 Minute of Sound. And that, it's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Phew. But before we get stuck into this joyride of a programme, let's hear from this week's Midori House session. Jason Isbell stopped by to play us tracks from his new record entitled Here We Rest. From that record, here he is with Alabama Pines.
Well, I moved into this room, if you could call it that, a week ago. I never do what I'm supposed to do, hardly even know my name anymore. When no one calls it out, kind of vanishes away. And I can't get to sleep at night, the parking lot so loud and bright. The AC hasn't worked in 20 years, probably never made a single person cold. But I can't say the same for me, I've done it many times. Somebody take me home through those Alabama pines. You can't drive through Talladega on that weekend in October. Just head up north to Jacksonville, cut around and over, watch your speed in Bowling Springs. Cause they ain't got a thing to do, they'll get you every time. Somebody take me home through those Alabama pines. Somebody take me home through those Alabama pines. Better make a stop in Wayne's. It's the only open liquor store north, and I can't stand the pain of being by myself without a little help on a Sunday afternoon. And I needed that damn woman like a dream needs gasoline. And I tried to be some ancient kind of man, one that's never seen the beauty in the world. But I tried to chase it down and make the whole thing mine. Now somebody take me home through those Alabama pines. Somebody take me home through those Alabama pines. I've been stuck here in this this room, if you could call it that. A year or two, I never do what I'm supposed to do. I don't even need a name anymore.
And that was Alabama Pines by Jason Isbell, and you'll be hearing more from him later on the show. So calm down, okay? Food writing. How do you eat out? I assure you that isn't a personal question. It's the title of the new book of Britain's most famous, possibly notorious restaurant critic, Giles Corran. How to Eat Out takes a sort of autobiographical, sort of didactic approach to getting people to have a bit more fun and get a bit more value out of a lunch or a dinner out.
A lot of it's a memoir, and then I took the memoir element of it up to about 21. Yeah. Up to sort of, you know, and then after that, I got a job. And as we all know, life becomes incredibly tedious after that. And then when you read any biography or autobiography, the best bit is like home, family life, school, bit of shagging, and then job.
Yeah.
And then it's about different kinds of food. And I've not written about individual Ponzi restaurants because very few people go to those. But so, you know, write about generically Pizza Express, what's gone wrong with it, burgers, pizzas. And then there is also this element which is literally how to do it. And I decided to do that because people will go and buy a book, and you've given it this title, How to Eat Out, and they read it, and then I'm writing, and then I ate some chips and I was sad because my father had died. And they go, where's the bit about how to eat out? So that, as a result of which...
There's a didn't element in it.
It's got to be there. Yeah. And so every chapter... in between each chapter, it's like how to complain, how to get the best table, how to order wine, how to, you know, I'm sort of taking the mickey. If you follow the advice, you'll be fine. But it's not boring, I hope. I mean, basically, I get treated fantastically well in restaurants because I'm a restaurant critic and I'm on the telly. And those are all the only two things that restaurant owners care about. Most people aren't.
Yeah.
And it must be galling for them to be. I remember what it was like to be a muggle, and you get treated poorly.
So it's about sort of learning, not tricks of the trade precisely, but, you know, about experience.
Yeah, it's almost tricks of the trade. It's how to get treated as well as me. And
it should be called How to Be on the TV and How to Be a Restaurant Critic.
Well, no, I mean, when I go to a restaurant, I book under an assumed name. They don't know it's me initially. And I can see that, and I ask quite often, for example, I go and meet some mate of mine who is not a dazzling disco TV mate, and he gets there first. They show him to the table by the loo, snug in between the loos and the cash register, the worst table in the house, which every restaurant tries to get rid of. Then I arrive with being called Mr. You know, Boogler or whatever I call myself.
Captain Haddock.
For example. Captain Birdseye I avoid because I did some Birdseye adverts in my youth. But Captain Haddock, for example. And I arrive, and then they sit me down, and then 2 minutes they say, would you like to move to this enormous executive table by the window next to the free bottle of wine? I go, yes, I would. And everyone ought to be able to do that, and this sort of tells you how.
And one of the interesting things is there are a couple of sort of, I don't know, things that are punctured in the book. Like you talk about the importance of local, which, you know, a lot of people think maybe 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, you know, that the best restaurants in the land had necessarily to be these opulent palaces, these escoffier kind of schooled things. And you sort of punch that, don't you? You go to France and you find it more difficult than it should be to get decent food all the time. And you talk about the importance of, you know, chatting up your local restaurant to always have a good time there.
Absolutely.
And these are the didactic parts of the chapter. It'd be nice to know, for example, about why local is so important. Yeah.
Well, there's two different things. I mean, in fact, oddly, these days, when you talk about local, it's often they're talking about sustainability and foraging and eating food from within town, which is an important thing. But I'm more interested in eating local to your house. When people ask me what's the best restaurant in London or whatever, or the world, I usually will say either the Italian or the gastropub or the Chinese near my house, because anything you can walk home from is marvelous. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to go to a restaurant and not drink because you're driving. You don't want to sit in the back of some stinking minicab, some bloke who doesn't know his way around London hours and hours. You don't, you know, so you don't get a bus. You know, that's the whole evening down the drain. So then you want it to be local, and you want to bump into your neighbours, and it's how life was in the old days when the great restaurants were when France and Italy sort of and Spain led the way. You know, that's all local. You know, a Spaniard doesn't go for miles and miles. He trawls down the street, popping into different little tapas bars.
Yeah.
And getting so you can do that more and more in London. And obviously, in Soho and Mayfair, and this is all fine. Where, for example, I live in Camden, it's getting better. But what I do is I go into my local Italian, and they've just got pizzas, you know, because that's what sells to them. And what did you have for dinner? Oh, well, we had this. Oh, do you think I can have some of that? Well, you know.
And there's a scheme for this, isn't there? This is about sort of going twice a week tipping decently and being friendly and actually treating it not like it's sort of like there's a palace and they're on a pedestal, but they're actually just giving you grub and you're paying for
Absolutely.
It. There is a transaction.
At that level of restaurant, they are your friends. And in France and Italy, which I no longer consider to be the icons or the beacons, but you go, a waiter and a punter go as equals. The hierarchy doesn't work in the same way. So, yes. And you tip, when you tip, you are not tipping for the service you've had, you're tipping for the service you want to get next time. So, and it doesn't, just because your bill's only 30 quid, it doesn't mean you have to give him 10% £3. You can't give a man £3. You know, give the guy a tenner, give it, says it, there you go, tenner, hand it, lovely. Don't just leave it and scuttle out. Give the guy a tenner, thanks, it was marvellous. What's your name again? Pedro, great. So, then go back within a week, so he hasn't got time to forget.
And people then at home are writing this down.
I should hope they are, yeah. And then you go, and then you say, oh, Mr. Corrin, how, you know, lovely to see you again. Have this particularly nice table. Can I recommend, you know, pout, you're in. And then they will cook beautifully for you. And that's better than going to the Ritz and being sneered at, I think.
I think it probably is. And do you feel that the centre of gravity has gone towards local, again, in terms of the restaurant around the corner from your house, rather than people wanting to go to the big name places? And also there's, I guess, the style of restaurants that you've charted in your columns in the Times over the last sort of three or four years have got a lot more low key, sort of almost ridiculously low key, like building sites with the kitchen at the back.
There's a place where you go and stand and that's really cool, but there's no actual food or booze and no phone number. No, I mean, there are people, my friend Russell Norman, who's just a wonderful guy who did Polpa and Polpetto and Spontina. And at first I used to razz him. What is this? I'm not queuing. I'm not getting in a car, crossing London on the off chance of getting some dinner. You know, I might eat my dinner at 8 o'clock. But eventually you arrive, you have a beer, you chat with the trendy tattooed person, and then they sit you down, you eat a bit of this, bit of that. You know, lots has changed. A lot more people can cook. With, you know, there has been this revolution. We have people to thank, like Gordon Ramsay and Jamie Oliver. Do you know, even Ainsley Harriott, all those people.
He gives you a nice quote on the cover of your book, doesn't he?
Gordon.
Giles is a scruffy twat.
Yes, I know.
Nice. I'm glad you put that on.
I'll tell you where I got that from. That was Heston. I'm great buddies with Heston. And I said, look, and he read the book and it was lovely of him to give the quote. And he's in LA most of it. I don't really see him so much. But I was on the GQ best dressed men.
Right.
I was like number 15 or something. You wouldn't think to look at what I'm wearing now. But in about 2006, that's because I was a GQ columnist. And what they do, Dylan Jones does, is gives the gongs to his pals. The moment I moved to Esquire, I was on the top 50 wankers list. It's amazing how they switch around.
Amazing.
But anyway, and Gordon, what happened? They said they went to, they wanted a celebrity mate to give you a quote for this. They went to Gordon. He said, Giles is a scruffy twat. And I thought, fine, Gordon, but that's going on the front.
One day,
that's going on the front of a book.
Writing about food requires this backlog of knowledge, and you get better at it. You know more stuff about it. Presumably, mm-hmm. you went on that you've made light sometimes in the past of that you didn't know much when you were at Tatler in the early days and things like that. But food bloggers are obviously people that sort of swamp the internet with views and taking photographs of all the gear that they're just about to sit down and eat. Where does that sit? I mean, presumably the trade of the restaurant critic is a sort of time-honoured one and a worthy one. And how do you feel that it is eroded by blogging?
Completely. I mean, bloggers, I think they're fantastic because they can eat, but they can't write. They have no training, they have no skill, they don't even know what an adjective is. But they can eat. So I don't have to waste my time going to rubbish restaurants. And I don't have to worry about the buzz, and I don't have to worry about who's first. It used to be a bit of a competition. Who's going to get first to this place? Usually Faye Masher on the Standard, because Faye knows ear to the ground, wants to stay ahead, and she has a lead time of about 24 hours. I've got 2 weeks on the match. Even if I went first, Faye would get in after me. And we used to worry who's going to... Now we can't do that, because the bloggers there, before it opens, they're there in the hard hat eating a sandwich and saying, this is the big new place.
That's possibly what it is going to end up like, though.
But I absolutely find that's all the more relaxing for the handful, me... And people like A.A. Gill, you know, good writer, Matthew Norman in The Telegraph, Jay Rayner, you know, good writers who are going to give you a real picture of the restaurant, a night out, what's the role it's going to play in your life. The bloggers go along, they take photos, they spoil everything. The first month in any restaurant is dead now, because it's just fatties with phones going click, click, click on everything. And then they because they have no constraint of an editor, they write a 5,000-word review. They write 1,000 words on each course. Then they complain that I don't really cover the food properly in my reviews, which are usually 700 or 800 words of life. Style, I mean, my life, what I'm up to, who I'm shagging, which is always my wife at the moment, and then you know, 300 or 400 words about the food, which is as much as you need, not 10,000 words describing how this chef possibly made the gravy.
Behaving yourself in restaurants, you also, and maybe we'll end on this, how to behave and how to complain. I suppose, are the British still too polite? Are they still too sort of divorced from where the kitchen comes from, or the food comes from, or their relationship with their waiter to really, you know? They balls it up when they've got a gripe.
I'm English, and I don't think you can be too polite. Yeah. You can be too reserved, too slow, too sort of wishy-washy. The standard English thing is to sit there in a restaurant with your wife saying, well, isn't this delicious? And then the waiter comes up and says, how is it? Oh, it's marvellous, it's lovely, it's great. And then you thank you so much. And then you get in the car and say, and your wife, you look at your wife and go, wasn't it awful? And go home and write a really angry letter and send it, maybe CC me and the Daily Telegraph. And then, what do you want me to do? You've eaten the meal, you've had a rubbish evening. That's too late, pal. Ruined.
This is a place you've reviewed well, and they think,
oh, we'll CC the restaurant critic. Then what you do is when it's taken, the food's taken a bit too long. You don't like the table. When they put you in the bad table, you just say, have you got a better table? It'd be lovely to have a. You know, they bring the soup. It's cold. You say, would you mind? Get them early. Very, very polite is great, but you must treat them like a child, firmly and with respect, and don't have a hissy fit.
And that was Giles Corran advising us on how to eat out. What a guy. That's what it says here in the script. I think it was Katie. It certainly wasn't me. Now we're off to East London for a lesson in how to rethink a global icon. Frieze magazine has, since 1991, been one of the stalwarts on the more artistic end of the newsstand, and of course lends its name and its directors to the even more famous art fair. I sat down with art director Sonia Djakova and editor Jennifer Higgy to talk about the magazine's new subtle facelift. Hi, it's Rob and Katie from Monocle.
Oh, great. Do you want to come up to the top floor, please?
Yeah, cool. Thanks.
In front of us, we've got the pilot issue, which was 1991, and it had a promising young artist who actually failed his promise, Damien Hirst, on the cover. and so, I mean, it's a beautifully designed thing. This was Tom Gidley. He was the first designer of Frieze. He started Frieze with Amanda Sharp and Matthew Slotover. He's now working full-time as an artist. And so he was the art director for a long time. It's sort of set up the look of Frieze that everyone knows now. I mean, the logo now is bigger and the format is bigger and it's changed. But, you know, the very clean design, the focus on a single image in the middle, the, you know, logo floating sweetly above it. Yeah, it's all still there.
Yeah.
I'm Jennifer Higgy, co-editor of Frieze.
And I'm Sonia Djakova, the art director of Frieze.
It's the first Frieze redesign for 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's a classic. You don't want to go kind of changing a classic too much. What were your cues to kind of kick off with?
Well, we thought editorially it'd be nice to have a sort of refresh the approach that we've had to the magazine. I mean, we've kept the main sections, the beginning, the middle and the back. We had a wonderful designer, Claudia Schenk, for the last 7 years, and she left. And so we thought, well, it's a good opportunity to relook at, you know, how we've been approaching design and its interaction with text and copy. And so Sonia came in and did a wonderful job.
Everything that I've done basically has a function. So I didn't sort of look at it and say, I really want to put my stamp on it, so therefore I'm going to just make it like this. I just looked at it and I thought, what, for me, in my view, doesn't work? What are the problems? And what are the good things? Mm-hmm. So I can sort of improve it rather than just do something for the sake of doing something.
You use that lovely phrase, evolution rather than revolution.
Yes. Evolution rather than revolution. So I...
have a flick.
Yeah, when you mention the different paper stock, the uncoated paper opens differently and it feels different. So it sort of almost opens by itself on that page and it makes it easier to find certain content. And then once you're in the middle section, you get things like the artist project that pops up, you know, and it just immediately takes you to the middle. Just by physically being smaller than the other pages, it opens up on that page. So it's a little trick to sort of get you inside.
It's not that we're suddenly doing artist projects, we've always done them, but this is the first time we've approached them like this.
It was just a way to frame them so that they become less obscure and more like a little discovery that you make as you go through a magazine.
Yeah. Is this a new font for some of these?
Yeah, they're, one of them... selfish things that I've done while doing the redesign. I just wanted to make it more fun for me.
I can't believe you. What? I mean, really?
To each month to design it, I just want to have more fun, and which means more typographic possibilities. Instead of just having one font to work with, I want to have two and to be able to choose any weight, whether to have all caps, upper and lower case, light, bold, big, small. I just want to have a whole kind of caboodle to play with rather than being restricted to, you know, traditionally limited kind of palette.
This is the magazine offices. That's Roz, our managing editor. Here are proofs on the table. You know, I've been working on the magazine a long time, and proofing it now, it was like proofing a different magazine because it looks so different. So that was exciting. Yeah. So I think it just gives everyone a sort of renewed sense of energy. A redesign is a very big thing in terms of, you know, when you work so intimately with a magazine you have done for a long time.
I've given myself a kick up the ass because it's just when you have to ask yourself, this is going to be printed, you know, how many times and sent around the world. Is it good enough? Can it be better? What can I do to make it better? And you just become quite judgmental of your own work, and it's good. I think that's what has to happen every time.
I'm assuming there's no greater subject to be talking about than art for a redesign. It must be wonderful to have that quality of image and that originality of image and copy to work with, I guess.
No, it's wonderful. The articles are great for me to read and really enjoy and then respond to.
I can't believe we've met an art director that's actually read some of the copy in the magazine. This is rare. Come on, we know this is rare.
No, all our art directors have always read all the copy in the magazine. They have to.
What's the pagination going to be, roughly?
It's going to be probably around 76 of editorial-ish. Yeah, and then ads, we're still working those out.
The cover lines are always an interesting issue for how much you decide to put on the cover. Is that for sort of fear of being didactic that you want to cut back what you sort of say on the cover?
I mean, doing those cover lines is harder than writing a 3,000-word piece. Because, you know, there's so much in the issue, and what you choose to flag up is, you know, I look at magazines, I don't know, like Vogue, that have about 150 bits of information on the cover, and it's like, oh, my God. No, we prefer restrained and elegant, I think. It's our longest conversation almost, the cover, you know, what we do for the cover in a sense, because it's how you flag up an issue and how you, you know, pull people in while, you know, treating all of the artist's work with integrity.
On Saturday night, I was at the Pentagram's 40th birthday party, and so many people said to me, you know, they noticed all these little things and people really paid attention, and I'm actually quite surprised. And little things even... I was very surprised about this, that someone has noticed the little shadows behind the pictures in the review section, which is just such a tiny detail. But I'm glad that people are seeing these things and noticing it.
That was Frieze Magazine art director Sonia Dickova and editor Jennifer Higgy. This is your weekly dose of culture on Monocle 24. Wonder what went down at Cannes Film Festival this year? Well, stay tuned.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we thought it was time to get a check-in about this year's Cannes Film Festival. This year, the glam factor stayed high despite some unseasonable storms. But what were the themes, the best films, and what were the most fun parties? To answer those questions, Katie Bilboa shared mic time with broadcast editor Lisa Campbell.
How did the reality measure up to your expectations? Because obviously we have this very glamorous, exciting kind of media view of Cannes.
Absolutely. You expect it to be, you know, star-studded and glamorous and absolutely thrilling. And in fact, it's, absolutely really measures up every bit as glamorous as you could possibly imagine it to be. It's got such an incredible buzz. It's teeming with big-name producers, with stars, with the world's press, tourists, hangers-on, wannabes, you name it, everyone is there. I think for everyone connected to the film industry, you really get a sense that you have to be there. And if you don't have a profile, you know, even if you're not actually producing anything at the moment, you have to be there. And, you know, perhaps you make out that you've got something in development. You know, you might have an idea on the back of a fag packet or something. But if you're not in Cannes, you may as well be dead, I think, is a real sort of sense that I got. I think also the kind of how seriously the festival is taken really, really comes across. I mean, you get this sense of the elevated role of culture in French politics and society. You know, the sort of risk-taking filmmakers are seen as true artists. You know, they're lionised, really, in a way that no other festival does that. And there's these sort of vaulted traditions, which I didn't realise. Every film, no matter how bad, gets a standing ovation. You know, so you're sitting there thinking, wasn't that good? You know, and everyone's on their feet for 15 minutes. But apparently, you know, that is one of the traditions. You know, the dress code is one of the great traditions of, you know, everyone's in their tux and their amazing dresses.
And with the standing ovation thing, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, do you think maybe it's a bit too nice for its own good, almost, and that it's actually quite difficult to tell if a film's going to do well or not, because everybody just stands up and claps whatever happened?
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to tell from the screenings, because there is always that reaction. But you do get the critics' reviews. And so every day, a magazine like Screen International, for example, which is a sister title of Broadcast Magazine, they produce this big table with all the critics from around the world. So it's from, you know, from the Times in the UK to the Australian and Danish papers. And they all give it their stars, and then they do a tally. So you get a really good sense then of what, you know, what are the films everyone's talking about, which have got the most stars, and much more realistic result.
In terms of the critical response to the films, do you notice any kind of variety in terms of where the critics come from? Do you see any kind of regional differences, or do all the critics tend to agree with each other? How does their reactions kind of compare?
You do tend to get, you know, for example, the Danish press gave 4 stars to the Thomas Vinterberg film. The Australian gave top marks to Lawless, because their scriptwriter is Nick Cave.
So there's quite a lot of loyalty.
I think there is, really. The festival does really divide into countries as well in terms of parties. You know, so there's the Nordic party and the German party. There was an Abu Dhabi huge party on the beach, and they had Kellis playing there. So, you know, you can kind of flip around different countries kind of, you know, all night, really. You know, there's at least half a dozen parties, you know, along the Croisette, and then there's the ones in the villas, there's the super yachts and the party boats. There's the really exclusive ones at the Hotel du Cap, where the stars tend to stay. So it's really happening.
A lot of these kind of industry events, quite often you get the sense that in the daytime things happen, but it's actually the parties at night where the business gets done. You know, everyone has a drink together and they make deals. Yeah. Is Cannes the sort of place where you got a feeling that business was happening and deals are being done, or is it more just about the celebrity and the screenings and the fun side of it?
It is both, actually, but the deals are definitely done. I mean, there's the Palais during the day is full of different, you know, there's the film commission stands, and there's all the different sales agents. You know, people do come away with a suitcase full of deal memos. There's also all the boats that are moored by the Albert Edouard, and they're, you know, people pay. The sort of financiers and bankers tend to take up those positions. And, you know, they're everything from sort of $100,000 a week to $400,000 and upwards. And, you know, Hollywood agents are sort of going up and down there and trying to find people to invest in their films. So it is absolutely all about business. And then there's also a trend, apparently someone was saying, that, you know, you're getting a lot more the kind of angel investors. So Russian billionaires who want to invest in a film, partly to say, you know, they're doing this amazing cultural thing. But they also, part of the deal will be tickets to premieres and parties and sitting next to Tom Hanks at dinner or whatever it is. So you know, that was quite interesting business-wise too.
What were people talking about? Because here in the UK, and I think in other countries around the world, there's a lot of press about this idea that no female directors were nominated for the Palme d'Or, and that became quite a big media story. But I wonder whether that was on the lips of people in Cannes, or whether it was just a small incident that got blown up.
Yeah, it was very, very much talked about. You know, it was the talk of the town at one point, but it quickly blew over. But, you know, it was really a bit of a storm in the teacup, I think, because it was started by a French feminist group, and they got quite angry at the lack of female directors. But, you know, it was just a fact this year that there weren't the films to enter into it. It wasn't like there was a sexist jury and they were saying, you know, oh, there's these amazing films by women, but they're by women and we're not having them. So, it, you know, it was a bit ridiculous. And there was Andrea Arnold was one of the jurors, you know, amazing director. And she was very clear about, let's not get into talk about quotas and everything else, because if you're in this competition, you deserve to be there and it's about merit. If we start then saying, you know, let's have 5 directors every year who are female, it's tokenist, and no female director wants that. So it quickly blew over, but there were rumours that this feminist group were going to storm the red carpet in beards, which, you know, would have been great. It didn't actually happen, but they were trying to get, there's an organisation called Women in Film and Television, and there was a party on the Pinewood boat. So lots of females had been approached to, you know, to take part in this, and everyone without exception was saying, no, this is ridiculous, and I'm not lending my support to this.
Oh, that's interesting. And if there are any feminist groups who are looking for inspiration for a protest, I like the idea of people turning up in beards. Yeah. So I think that's a bit of a shame that didn't happen. So let's get to the films now, because obviously that's what you're there to see, as well as the parties.
Killing Them Softly was... quite well rated. This is a stylish, hard-boiled crime drama, and it's by Andrew Dominik. It's violent, it's bleakly funny, it's beautifully filmed. I mean, there are some really amazing cinematic moments in the rain and sort of slow-mo gunshots and things. And it's based on a crime novel, Kogan's Trade, but it's also set against the backdrop of a country in the midst of its election in 2008.
Are there any other films that stood out to you?
It doesn't sound like the best sell in the world. It's a film about old age and an elderly couple, and one of them has a stroke. So, it's Michael Haneke, who is clearly a genius, and an old age remains something of a great taboo in cinema. It's just so beautifully done. I think you can see, you know, his background, his sort of theatre background really comes across. It's very measured and very controlled. It's a hugely intelligent drama about something which affects us all, and we might not want to confront our own mortality and, you know, potential physical frailty, but it's going to happen. Lawless, which is the John Hillcoat film, very well-paced, entertaining story of bootlegging in 1931 Virginia. This is the one adapted by Nick Cave. It's sort of, very violent, consistently violent, so it might put some people off. I mean, there's one character who has sort of vital parts removed, shall we say, and they end up pickled in a jar, and there's a pretty gruesome throat-cutting incident. But it's superb cast of hot young actors, Shia LaBeouf and Tom Hardy. Really, really brilliantly acted. It's very frustrating, though, because quite unintelligible Southern accents at times. So, you know, that kind of mumble American kind of thing. And it was just impossible. So I ended up following the French subtitles at that point. So I think for international audiences, if you have the subtitle option, then...
That's a better option, yeah.
It is, yeah.
That was Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast Magazine, talking to culture producer Katie Bilbao. It's not over yet, chaps, because we've still got lots to look forward to. More of that Jason Isbell session and an interview with the man himself. We'll hear how Havana-based art collective Los Carpinteros have been making waves in Buenos Aires and soak up a minute of sound from the sunset sanctuary that is London's Chelsea Flower Show. What a jolly thing to do. Time to hear some more of that lovely Midori House session from the wondrous Jason Isbell. Take it away, Jason.
This one's called Tour Duty. I'm arriving on day's last train, stepping on the platform, trying to see you through the lane. And I don't know the ways you've changed since I left, and I really don't care, 'cause I've done my tour of duty. Now I'm home and I ain't going anywhere. And I taught myself to tolerate the pain, the loneliness and boredom, and the work I did in vain, all the work we did in vain. Now I'm not the same as I was. But I've done my tour of duty, now I'll try to do what a civilian does. And I promise not to bore you with my stories, and I promise not to scare you with my tears. And I never would exaggerate the glory, I seem so satisfied here. I've been eating like I'm out on bail, collard green, chicken wings, and oysters by the pail. Eating oysters by the pail, making up for those lost days. 'Cause I've done my tour of duty, now I'm gonna put you in the family way.
children telling secrets. We'll probably cry like old women drinking gin. 'Cause I've done my tour of duty, now I'm home and I ain't leaving here again. Well, I've done my tour of duty, now I'm home and I ain't leaving here again.
That was Tour of Duty by Jason Isbell. What might that song be about? What does Jason Isbell sound like when he's not singing? The mystery ends here, because Andrew Mueller interviewed him for us.
The song you played there earlier was Tour of Duty, which is almost part of a trilogy or triptych, even now, of the songs you've written about soldiers, is Dress Blues, which I still think is by a street the best song that anyone's written about the Iraq War.
Oh, thank you.
And Soldiers Get Strange from your most recent album. What is it about that subject that keeps you returning to it? And what I was also wondering is, do you talk to other soldiers, or do you talk to soldiers, rather, mm-hmm. before you write those songs, or have you talked to soldiers since about those songs? It must be kind of a hard situation to nerve yourself to write about, I guess.
It can be. But yeah, I've talked before and after. I've talked to guys who have dealt with that kind of stuff and the families of people who have not survived. And it's the elephant in the room, you know. I think a lot of people in the States, they get so oversaturated with news coverage that eventually the war becomes another movie to them, you know, and that's kind of the line in Dress Blues, where I refer to it as a Hollywood war, because it looks like a movie set after a while. After you're just, you know, you get on one channel, you have the Kardashians, and on the next channel, you have Afghanistan. Pretty much those things start blending together, especially for younger people. And the reality of it is that there are actually people at war, and they're in the most intense human situation they could be in right now, and they're young people. And to me, that feels very personal, because in a lot of ways the issues that I have and I don't want to use the word freedom, but the things that I'm able to do because the state exists, you know, drive on roads, get educations, whether you agree with how they do all their business or not, which I certainly don't, but those things are made possible because people are going through the most intense possible human situation. Now, sometimes when it happens, it's not necessary, just like anything else. There are bad ideas everywhere, but if you sit down and personally talk to the people who are dealing with this, you know, you find that most of them are very cerebral about the whole thing. They consider, why am I there? Why was I fighting? Why was I killing people? What effect has it had on me? You know, they're not stupid kids for the most part, and they're not over there just waving a flag, yelling about freedom and killing people. It has a big effect on them, and it has a big effect on small towns, whether somebody lives or dies. You know, the percentage of people in those towns that go to war, you don't hear about thousands of kids going from New York City to Afghanistan, but you hear about them coming from Georgia and from Mississippi and Alabama, and those communities that they come from are heavily impacted by that, because everybody knows everybody. If somebody gets their leg blown off, everybody in town knows that that person doesn't have a leg before they see them at the grocery store the next week.
Another song you played there, Alabama Pines, which is the opening track of your new album, which is inordinately focused on your home state. The title track, I believe I'm right in saying, used to be Alabama's state motto. Here
it was, yeah, for a little while there.
So did this album come from a process of having been away, being a touring musician for years and wanting to go back home and yearning for home, as the character in Alabama Pines appears to be?
We spent a lot of time at home in the particular 9 or 10 months that I spent writing this record. So a lot of it came out of being reacquainted with people and different types of personalities that I hadn't been around much, traveling.
And these are the people you grew up with?
Yeah. Not, you know, sometimes they're the same people, sometimes they're not. But you know, these are the personalities that I grew up around and the stories that I grew up hearing. And, you know, essentially they're the same stories, so you sort of shut yourself off to them after a while, and then you start traveling, and you get to hear different stories, and you meet different kinds of people, and you kind of forget. And this was the most time I'd been at home in probably 10 years leading up to that. So I got a lot out of listening to the kind of people that I began as, you know, the kind of people that I started off around.
And I guess the kind of person, that kind of people that you could have been now if you hadn't gone away to be a musician.
Or maybe that I am, you know. There's not that much difference. I mean, I have a different job and I work in different places, but concerns are the same and goals are very often the same. And that was something that I don't think I'd completely realized until this particular period of time, until I really spent time around those folks and thought, you know, the people that I grew up hating and wanting so much to get away from really aren't that different from me at all.
But do you enjoy Alabama as a backdrop, I guess? Because it seems rich ground for storytelling, songwriting, because everybody has a preconception of Alabama that
right.
you can either tap into or you can play around with. It, for some reason, though, as you say, those concerns are universal and certainly can be found anywhere in the United States. If somebody wrote a song of an album of songs about blue-collar struggles set in Vermont or Rhode Island, it would sound kind of weird.
Well, I don't know, man. Deer Tick's been doing it about Rhode Island for a while. People from Rhode Island are crazy, just for the record. They're all insane. No, it's, you know what? I don't think that's a real issue. I mean, having Alabama as a backdrop is kind of like having a size 11 foot for me. It's like, it doesn't matter whether I like it or not. That's what I'm here with. That's what I'm stuck with. I might as well use it to my advantage, you know. But there are people like that make regionally specific records that I think are really great, and they all boil down to the same themes. I mean, Josh Ritter does it. Calexico does it. You know, Deer Tick does that. A lot of people make, you know, music that's about Texas, and they only play in Texas, and they never leave Texas. And sometimes I'm really glad they never leave Texas. But, you know, I think that the concerns are the same, really. You're just using a different palette depending on where you're from.
And that was Jason Isbell talking to Andrew Miller, and we'll be treating you to one more of his tracks at the end of the show. What a tease, here on Culture, with me, Robert Band.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
Who is the true conservative? This is the question voters in primaries are going to have to be asking themselves.
Wake up in New York to The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. A touch more art? I thought so. Last week, I met their gallerist in Cuba. This week, we follow the Havana-based art collective Los Carpinteros to the Feina Art Center in Buenos Aires, where they showed two large-scale installations and a never-before-seen sculpture created especially for the art center's Sala Molinos exhibition space as part of Art Buenos Aires. Since the Feina Art Center's opening in September 2011, it has been hailed as a cultural linchpin for the Argentinian capital and has already received more than 75,000 visitors during its debut. Our man in Buenos Aires, Ian Mount, checked it all out.
This week, the art world elite of Buenos Aires flocked to the new Feina Art Center, a converted grain warehouse in the riverfront neighborhood of Puerto Madero. They came for the opening of the first Argentine show of Los Carpinteros, the Cuban art collective of Marco Castillo and Dagoberto Rodriguez that's known for its huge, surreal installation pieces.
Oh, I am Mauro Herlitzka. I am a collector here in Buenos Aires. And I think to have Carpinteros at the Feina Art Center here in Buenos Aires is a great opportunity to see their production here. It's a big effort to bring those big installations to our city.
Equal parts technical virtuosity and conceptual fantasy, the three pieces in the Buenos Aires show turn a playful and sometimes caustic eye on urban development and progress. In one piece, a functioning set of street lamps is connected by winding pipes that look like the roots of an invasive plant species. In another, called The Neighborhood, A group of boxy cardboard tract houses sit in a pile, as if dumped by a careless contractor. The buildings resemble the neat, repetitive shacks where Latin American governments house their poorest citizens on city outskirts. And in the most eye-catching piece, called Airplane, a small aircraft is peppered from beneath with indigenous Amazonian tribal arrows, apparently by angry tribe members below the plane's flight path. As Marco Castillo explains...
The important thing of this piece is not the actual object, it's what happened to the object, you know? We actually didn't fabricate anything there. We only took a real airplane, Piper Comanche from the 70s, a typical airplane to go to your ranch in the Amazonas, for example. And the arrows, we got them from not far from San Pablo, where there is a big contrast. San Pablo is this giant concrete city full of urban people, but also full of business, money, and is surrounded by this wildlife, no?
Los Carpinteros are Cubans who now live largely in Spain, and the politics of their work isn't easy to pin down. It's not pro or anti-Castro as much as an attempt to use humorous surrealism to make people think. Here are Castillo and Rodriguez.
I think we are politically enough.
Yeah, I think it's, the politics is part of our work, but it's not the main course, you know?
We are very interested in all sort of reaction to reality, and sometimes it's political, sometimes it's social, sometimes it's just aesthetical, you know, it depends.
Whether political, social, or aesthetic, the Los Carpinteros' focus on progress and urban development seems especially appropriate to the show's location.
I'm so lucky to create a new neighborhood, the newest neighborhood in the city of Buenos Aires, in a place that was abandoned.
That's Art Center owner Alan Faena, the Buenos Aires property developer and hotelier, famous for always wearing head-to-toe white. Faena developed Puerto Madero, an abandoned port area once full of collapsing warehouses and grain elevators. Besides the Faena Art Center, it's now home to the most expensive apartment towers in the city. At Tuesday's VIP opening at the Art Center, a crowd of art world glitterati, including Warhol friend Marta Minujín, walked among the installations in the cavernous white interior of the remodeled warehouse. As they sipped champagne, they offered their views on the show.
You have the work of art just like 20 centimeters away from you, and you can see it from every perspective, and I know, amazing.
It just has a visual presence which is incredible.
I think it's kind of pointing out the irony of technology and its lack of success.
It's so light and so unstable. You say it's the problem of housing nowadays in all around the world.
2 nights after the Los Carpinteros opening, the action moved across town to Palermo. There, some 3,000 people lined up to take part in the opening of Arte Va, the city's sprawling annual art fair. 250,000 people visited last year, and with over 100 galleries from 15 countries, Arte Va has grown into one of the biggest art events in Latin America. For Monocle, in Buenos Aires, I'm Ian Mount.
And if you're in the Buenos Aires neck of the woods, the Los Carpinteros show is on at the Faena until the 12th of August. Well, that's nearly all we have time for this week, but back by popular demand, it's time for the indulgent but intriguing 1 minute of sound. This week, we dispatched culture producer Katie Bilbao to the Chelsea Flower Show, Britain's best showcase for the manicured lawn and the topiaried shrub and a highlight of the horticultural calendar. Here's what she made while dodging the sprinklers and admiring the flora.
Thank you very much.
You're from the BBC?
That was a 1 minute of sound from the Chelsea Flower Show, courtesy of Katie Bilboa. Crikey. Well, that brings us to the end of the show here on Monocle 24. It's been a festival of food, frieze, film and fun, but fear not, we return in a week's time with an equally delectable joy of a show where we'll be asking what's hot on Broadway ahead of the Tony Awards and hearing about Israel's bomb shelters, which have been transformed into recording studios. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and my mama on the mixing desk was Holly the Fighter Fisher. Time for one final song this week from his beautiful Midori House session that he performed here for us. This is Jason Isbell again. Thanks for tuning in.
She loves me. She loves me not. Don't bring it up, 'cause she's all I've got. I don't ever ask why she's around. I just reach for the stars with my feet on the ground. My feet on the ground. A dog-eared page, a book I've read so many times, it's all there in my head. I watch every word reflect in her eyeglasses. I know when she'll laugh, I know when she'll cry, I know when she'll cry. But save it for Sunday, save it for the choir and everyone, and save it for Sunday. We got care of our own. This side of town, you can't walk alone. A girl like yourself probably wind up gone. Just talk about work, gonna open a bar with 85 bouncers and one lonely star. One lonely. Save it for Sunday. Save it for the choir and everyone. Save it for Sunday. Yeah. 'Cause we got care of our own. We got care.